excited about it. Thank you for being here. There's three speakers, and then Werner Bonfeld is going to act as a discussant. So, four speakers. Cindy Katz is coming first. She's a New Yorker and here at the CUNY Graduate Center. And then Shiri Pasternak is following. Great. She's from here from Toronto. And then Sylvia Federici is the third speaker who, I don't know, are you in Maine now or here?
Yeah.
But back and forth. Okay. Here and there. So I'm not going to take much more time, but it's like 20-minute talks. I'll try and be generous, but keep you going.
Don't be generous.
Okay.
Right.
Go for it.
A little generous. Okay, hi, everybody. It's great to be here, and I'm thrilled to have wormed my way on this panel. I got out of literally a prison. Jesse tried to put me with the carceral people, but I said, no. Okay. The title of my paper is Accumulation, Excess, Childhood. And it's toward a counter-topography of risk and waste, but it's really literally toward a counter-topography because there's no time for the counter-topography. So, anyway, we could talk about that in discussion. So maybe the better subtitle would be Playing for Time. I look. Insecurity ricochets through contemporary life, often roosting in and around children and childhood. A welter of management strategies have been devised in a variety of quarters to mediate and manage these insecurities, whether political, economic, cultural, or political, ecological. This piece grows out of an ongoing project that I call Childhood as Spectacle, and my long-term interest in social reproduction, and what, as a theoretical formation, it does to and for Marxist and other critical political economic analyses. After more than 30 years of Marxist-feminist interventions around these issues, there are all too commonly remain symptomatic silences around social reproduction in the analyses of capitalism, so that working through what's at stake in these issues and their occlusion, I hope to offer a useful and vibrant theoretical framework for thinking about and examining geographies of children, youth, and families. Building this framework calls into play three overlapping issues: neoliberal capitalism in crisis, and David Harvey's notion of accumulation by dispossession, my evolving ideas around childhood as spectacle as a cultural formation associated with contemporary political economic crisis, the affective state, in every sense of the term, and the figuration of the child as waste. And I'm interested in thinking about and looking at how that figuration, the child as waste, might be turned around to find liberatory potential in and through the site of children's play and time. Okay, very quickly, because this group does not need, and after this week, we don't need a long analysis of global capitalism in crisis. We need it to end in the good way. The permutations of this crisis since 2008 were shaped, of course, in more than three decades of neoliberal policies and imperatives, among them the offloading of responsibility for social reproduction from the state and capital to individuals, households, and, quote, civil society. Disinvestments in the social wage more generally, and the privatization of public and common goods, spaces, and services, the commodification of formerly free or shared goods and services, and a generalized marketization and financialization of everyday life and its customary material social practices. This much, perhaps, we all know. That these concerted policies and practices were accompanied by others that called forth an entrepreneurial and self-sufficient self, and there continue to be fierce struggles over these changes and the variegated attempts on the part of those in power whose interests they serve to naturalize them and all of their divisions. This political-economic situation meshes with Harvey's notion of accumulation's crisis. Harvey argues that capital's periodic crises are crises of overaccumulation. In other words, there's a chronic tendency in capitalism to produce surpluses of capital in various forms, money, commodities, productive capacity, along with surpluses of labor, but for various reasons, no apparent means to bring them together profitably. The key for capitalists is to find profitable ways to absorb and set in motion capital surpluses or face the sorts of devaluations associated with the current crisis. Harvey suggests three means to resolve them, which it's spatial, which involves things like opening new markets, developing new resources, spatial fix, or developing and deploying new pools of labor through strategies associated with accumulation by dispossession. Temporal means of solution, which include investment in long-term infrastructure, public works, or the sorts of social investments, among them research and education and the support of the arts. These things take capital out of circulation for a long time. And the third is spatio-temporal strategies for Harvey, which combine the two, which really are the other two. It's just the fetishization of three that makes him say there are three, because there's really just one. While Harvey is clear about how dispossession works through familiar strategies like privatization of common resources, the new enclosures, or displacing people from resources, he's less clear on how class is braided with racialized, sexist, imperial projects to foster, enable, and naturalize dispossession as much as its divisions, while at the same time diminishing the prospects for social investment. The costs of labor are routinely cheapened through disinvestments in the social wage and reliance on privatized strategies of social reproduction, which are constantly made invisible through their willed naturalization. Investments in children, then, can be seen as a temporal fix and yet almost never are the weapon of choice for diffusing crises of overaccumulation. Why not make those questions central to this accumulation crisis? What if surpluses were absorbed by investments in public education, parks and playgrounds, and health, social housing, rather than subprime mortgages and similar predatory gimmicks of finance capital? In other words, the scale of dispossession is not just witnessed in uneven geographical developments like gentrification, colonialism, suburbanization, or so-called urban renewal, but also at the intimate scales of everyday life. Foreclosure takes place quite literally at the very heart of people's existence. Disinvestment in social reproduction, then, is a key means of accumulation by dispossession. And global expansion is riddled with and enabled by intimate dispossessions. Theories that fail to attend to this realm of contradiction neglect an enormous reservoir of political possibilities, and these drive my concerns. I'm going to skip a broader discussion of childhood as spectacle, which is, I have a friend who says, everybody who says, from the much bigger project, from the much smaller project than this, is childhood a spectacle, but I just want to say that it calls forth three, and in my case, it's really four, figures of the child as accumulation strategy and commodity, and I make that one for now, ornament and waste. And those three are obviously interconnected and have different means of management and vigilance around them. So I am just going to say that I've one of the ways that I've looked at this is about thinking about children as accumulation strategies, parental, middle-class parents, and others, strategies of hypervigilance around protecting these high-value assets, to use the military term, and then children as ornaments is a kind of flattening of the historical sense of childhood in the ways it takes place, and also literally as ornaments. If you read the New York Times, which unfortunately we probably all do, children are kind of a celebrity and other accessory. I've actually seen an article that the latest accessory in the Hamptons. That was a few years ago, so they're probably disposed of by now. Anyway, children as waste, which is obviously the constitutive outside of the other configurations represents dispossession on the hoof, as it were. Excess by various regimes of capital accumulation, these young people have a value analogous to an industrial reserve army. They are simultaneously a social body that must be contained, and management and waste management around people as around things is big business. The child as waste is a specter that haunts the figure of the child as accumulation strategy and its management, and also occlusion through relations and practices of social reproduction enables, maintains, and propels particular modes of capital accumulation. So the larger paper looks at three moments and means of managing children as waste: the school-to-prison pipeline, children in the military, formal and informal, and children in super exploitative labor conditions. And in the case that I look at in this paper, it's the ship-breaking industry, which is a growing industry in Southeast Asia in particular. In these three realms, children are actors as much as subjects of capital accumulation facing differentiated modes of project. So I'm just going to touch quickly on each of these three waste management strategies. The school-to-prison pipeline is, of course, familiar to everyone in this room, I bet, as shorthand for the material and discursive continuities between schools and prisons in the lives of poor children in the U.S., particularly children of color, who commonly attend poor and under-resourced schools that limit their educational horizons, limit the chances that their educational needs will be met, and increase the chances that disciplinary infractions will be dealt with more harshly than is the case in more privileged environments. As Patricia Kruger's work shows, the combination of undereducating, stepped-up policing and surveillance, and often unforgiving punishment in certain school environments seems to streamline the way to prison rather than other futures for children in poor neighborhoods. Michelle Fine and Jessica Ruglis convincingly analyze neoliberal education as a form of accumulation by dispossession. They demonstrate how students in poorer school districts, but others as well, are dispossessed from quality education and even a diploma, as the funds for public education, and we're in a week where 6,000 teachers were fired, are siphoned off into standardized testing, which is big business, a private business, for those who produce, assess, and help prepare students for the barrage of tests that pass for education these days, the days spent in testing, talk about a waste of time, and into other things like security and policing measures in schools, even primary schools. And I'm just not going to dwell on this except to say that I always use this ungrammatical phrase, there is not no money. The austerity question is a bogus one. And if we need any proof, which I doubt anyone here knows, needs, it's that according to the mayor himself's office of statistics, in 2006, it cost almost $171,000 to keep a child in secure detention, where the cost to educate one student in a public high school was just shy of $12,000. So it's 15 times more to keep them caged, and yet we have no money. Okay, in the interest of time, I'm not going to discuss the second figure of the child as waste in the military, except here to note, statistics are my friends today. People younger than 18 and as frequently as young as 6 are active combatants now in about 75% of all conflicts going on now. So that this as a kind of siphoning of possible futures, literally lives at stake, is just a growing and huge problem. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Similarly, I'm just going to say that the ship-breaking industry, in which I talk about the other form of the child as waste, is one of the most debilitating and hazardous forms of labor in the world these days. It's arduous, it's hazardous. The ships literally are old, most of them old tankers, oil tankers that are beached in around Southeast Asia in particular, where they used to be kind of dry docked in the global north, now that they're in the global south, where they are all the interest in recycling ships is all the greater during recessions and crises of capital, so that it, because all the materials are cheapened by the labor of children and others who work under these, like broiling sun, rust, you know, acetylene torches, falling pieces of ships on them. Limbs are routinely not just broken, but destroyed and amputated. And the children, many of the children involved in this have been sent to these areas to work by advances paid to their parents, so that the youthful workers are essentially captive and held under these terrible conditions. So this is serious waste. Wasting of lives. Okay, waste management of all kinds is a big business, of course. It's a key site of social investment through which the prison system or the military or other operations of organized violence, through killing labor practices and through more routine management strategies such as the everyday violence of neglect, disease, and poverty. These material forms and practices are means of channeling and containing excess to populations whose labor might be tapped at another time or place. Their bodies must not be only contained, but their visible containment disciplines those who are not waste. Waste management is also a means of not seeing and naturalizing the production of waste and its thick, bloody integument with the production of value. In his fascinating work on waste and the production of value, Jesse Goldstein, sitting in the front row, limiting my time, suggests that human waste management is stages the violence of erasure. This perspective leads me to a concern with the idea of recuperation and the political possibilities from and in the site of waste. How can we recuperate and lay claim to all the lost potential, flesh and mind, from the searing waste I've delineated here? And here I want to look briefly, because we definitely, it's only 10:25, we need some uplifting something after this. I want to look briefly at children's play and the mimetic faculty. In a twisted parallel to shipbreaking, which is wasting but recuperates waste to capital as its object, the mimetic faculty is a creative and potentially recuperates creativity wasted, and I'd like to say not for capital. Fittingly, the mimetic faculty crops up in play, which is often constituted as a waste of time. The mimetic faculty can be seen beautifully in children's play, and I've written about this elsewhere, and I'll just briefly say that in my ethnographic research on children's work and play in rural Sudan, I saw how children played with, worked, engaged in playful work, workful play, and played at some things that they other times worked at. They played vivid games of fields in miniature and store and house, and they created little miniature landscapes wherein they enacted the tasks and social relations associated with agriculture, commerce, and domestic life. And in these activities, children transformed local debris, and I mean that literally, domestic waste, agricultural detritus, scraps, and dung into amazing imaginary worlds of farming and economic and social exchange in which they had a place, even a future. They internalized and worked out and expressed the economic relations they saw around them, and they played a game of fields called subsistence fields and one called tenancies. And they had money circulating in tenancies and surplus crops, food crops in subsistence fields. And they worked these things out with a little bit of a tweak. In a gesture towards utopia, no one went broke. Everyone at least had some assets, and the exchanges were relatively equal. They were often riotous and always exuberant. the mimetic faculty was everywhere. As Walter Benjamin says, he tells us the mimetic faculty is not simply the ability to see resemblance and create similarities between things, but it's the flash of insight read off of and made in the process that impels a moment of invention. Playing at something has a fugitive or fleeting aspect that can spark recognition that even the original is made up by us and might be made different. Play is identity-making and world-making. And Benjamin is particularly insightful about play with debris and the ways it accesses the social and historical through a kind of tactile social-historical knowing that is in all of us what McTausig calls wild imagining. It has revolutionary potential. Its fantasies are reservoirs for thinking and making new ways of living. So just quickly to sum up, play, children's and others, is intrinsic time, time lived as disposable, though not at all a waste of time. Marx was clear that social wealth was based on disposable time, and Jesse's written wonderfully about this. Childhood is in many ways disposable time. How else can we understand playtime or the pleasures of doing nothing, which is increasingly a privilege to go out and do nothing, which, of course, we all know we spent our childhoods doing, in all of its fluid openness to everything. Play, thus, can be understood as a non-instrumentalist state of being and openness to becoming. It's generative and full of possibilities. If, as Marx tells us, the whole development of wealth rests on the creation of disposable time, isn't that time, children's time, play time, thinking and imagination time, something not to be wasted, let alone destroyed? At one level, Marx was being elemental. Without time that exceeds bare survival, that is disposable time, there's no potential for building surplus. Non-productive time and the time of work are needed to expand and potentially make good non-production time through the materials, social practices of social reproduction, consumption, and leisure. There's a lot of disciplining associated with capitalist production, focused on channeling that time and how it is spent, by whom, so that idleness is reserved for some and punished in others. At its core, then, disposable time is social time. It's a resource, it's a source and outcome of wealth, of the creation of wealth. It's best understood not as waste, but as wealth and potential wealth, as something to be shared, played with, reimagined, as the very fiber of what it means to be a person and to be social. I'm not wasting any time. Why not think of a politics that builds upon and shares disposable time? We have that potential now. It's possible, for example, to imagine to restructure work time and meaning so that their logic is no longer that some work to the bone, whether through excessive hours, protracted commutes, or intensified productivity demands, while others are idle and made into waste that must be contained at a quite high cost. Taking a leaf from the sorts of utopian gestures in the children's play and imagination mentioned just a minute ago, but well exceeding it, the imagination that would refashion debris to make toys of garbage and elaborate worlds of waste, literally of shit, is somewhere in almost everyone. That imagination is a revolutionary imagination, if you will, and is ready to be released into making something else. It might be realized in making disposable time the social resource that it is through insisting on and making times and spaces for creativity, research, writing, playing art, playing music, drama, thought, dance, and the like. I know this sounds dreamy, but it is not dream talk. It's a way out of the nightmare of austerity and waste management. This sort of openness is perhaps the deepest lesson to learn from children's play. The promise and danger of understanding childhood time in tension with the deep injustices associated with constituting some children as waste, hidden by the ruthless global management of that waste. We are all in this together, and the loss of anyone's creativity or creative potential is a tragedy of the commons and a loss to our common future. No one is disposable, and disposable time is a collective and expanding resource that has all kinds of possibility for making change. The children with whom I worked in Sudan made whole worlds out of shit. If that is not an inspiring metaphor for politics now, what is?